Welcome to episode 14 of the Serious About Security podcast for Monday, August 20th, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group, Secure Purdue, and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SIRIUS, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the hosts of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at SIRIUS.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP. In announcements today, the next Greater Lafayette Security Professionals meeting will be on Thursday, September 13th. It will be a workshop using Metasploit to probe for vulnerabilities in virtual environments.
The schedule for the fall SIRIUS Security Seminar is starting to be filled up. As classes begin this week, in fact, the first session will be on the 22nd with Scott Anderson from Lockheed Martin. On August 29th, we have Lewis Shepard from Microsoft. And on September 5th, Ed Lopez from Fortinet will be presenting. These seminars begin at 4:30 p.m. in Stuart G52 and will also be shown on the Purdue channel in the Greater Lafayette area. These seminars are recorded and made available as podcasts and on YouTube. Information is available at the SIRIUS website, www.cerias.purdue.edu.
And we have a few items in news today. Microsoft released several security updates for August. Five of those were critical, four were important, and they were released on August 14th, on obviously a Tuesday. Google Chrome, the stable channel was updated to 20.0.1180.79, which corrected a Adobe Flash Player issue on August 14th. And the Flash Player also was updated to 11.3.300.271 for Windows and 11.2.202.238 for Linux, also on August 14th. And that is the news. And for articles today, we have the first one is kind of a big news item. It has to do with a Wired staff member, writer, Matt Honan. He was hacked by he was targeted for a hack on his account. Basically, the hackers wanted access to his Twitter account, and they used several, they used password reset methods in order to gain access to his Twitter account. The attack basically went that they were able to compromise his Apple email account, which basically allowed them to reset passwords on other accounts, including Twitter, and eventually get access to his Twitter account and post bad things on his Twitter account. So it's very interesting because it kind of highlights the faults behind some of the password reset methods that are used. I seem to recall on Apple, what they needed was his billing address and the last four digits of his credit card number. And Amazon, the hackers were able to add a new credit card to his account using his billing address. And then they were able to, using that credit card number they just added, they were able to figure out the last four digits of the other credit card numbers that were on his account. And via that information, they were able to get into his Apple account. And then once they had his email address, they were able to reset passwords on other things, such as Twitter. In addition to that, were able to use the remote wipe feature within that Apple has to delete his iPhone data and his data on his Mac and things like that, including some pictures that he regrettably had not backed up. So it was a huge in the security news, and there's quite a few articles around the internet about it. So I just wanted to know what you guys thought of this hack.
Well, I think at the heart of it really was a social engineering attack that allowed all these other things to take place during the attack. It was very interesting that the hackers were able to kind of play off Apple and Amazon off one another. Basically, I'm trying to find that little quote. there was a great quote that said the very piece of information that Apple considered secure, Amazon did not. So it was, which was basically the last four digits of the credit card number. By having that information, as you said, in the billing address, they were able then to issue the password reset. And once they were able to get in there and take control of the account, they were able to elevate it and do all those additional things that took place. So, I mean, there's a lot of lessons to be learned here. As you said, Preston, this was huge news in the security realm. It seemed like every day saw articles popping up on this. And it's interesting, you know, Matt Honan described that he was able to communicate with one of the hackers. And he was kind of like, you know, was this because of my position as a technical writer? And it's like, no, you had a really cool Twitter handle, Matt, M-A-T. You know, so some innocuous piece of information that they decided, well, this would be a great Twitter account to kind of pwn, you know, and own it. The side effect was, as Matt described in the article, was, you know, he lost pictures of his young daughter, and he also lost pictures of family members that are no longer with him. And you know, he said, you know, he took some accountability there, saying, you know, I didn't back up that data. What's really puts that in perspective is, you know, a lot of times you think of backing up data. He had multiple Apple devices that were compromised. So, you know, his iPhone was wiped, his MacBook was wiped, his iPad was wiped. So, you know, to just be a little fair to Matt in this scenario, you know, he was probably thinking, I have three copies of this data. But because of the fact he had that feature, you know, being able to remotely wipe his device turned on, which can be a great feature when it's done to do what it was designed to do, which is, you know, someone's taken control of my, you know, if someone has stolen my laptop, I want to remotely wipe it. But in this case, you know, the hackers were able to use that technology against him. And ultimately, you know, that's really, I think, where, you know, the impression I got was it was not good that his Twitter account was hacked and that these messages were posted as him. But I think his Twitter followers probably figured out rather quickly something strange is going on here. This guy, you know, either went totally off the reservoir or, you know, something happened to his account, you know, and it's been hacked. But the data that he lost as a result of this compromise is what's going to be haunting him, you know, as time goes on. So, but, you know, a lot of things, I saw some things in regards to the article because Gmail was involved in there at some point. You know, two-factor authentication may have prevented that. And I'm not so sure I totally agreed with that. Ultimately, at the heart of this attack, what really seemed to jumpstart it was the social engineering. And that's a, you know, I'm curious to see what your guys' thoughts are. What can we do? Because in this case, you know, companies like Apple and Amazon don't necessarily make it common knowledge how these things work, but obviously the hackers were able to obtain that type of information. So as a consumer, the information I'm protecting, I may not realize is the same, you know, I might not consider some information confidential, whereas if a hacker can get into it, they know that they can use that then to unlock my Amazon account or my Apple account. So that's, you know, that's some of my thoughts on it. I'm curious what you think of the social engineering angle.
Well, I think that was, you know, very important. In fact, that was the key ingredient in this attack. And social engineering problems in security have been around for a long time. In fact, it was highlighted in the article, Kevin Mitnick, that was his techniques. He wasn't an especially technically adept hacker, but he could certainly persuade people to give him information that they probably shouldn't have. And so this is another example of that. And if you read the article, it also talks about the attacker who gained access to the account. He seemed to have, oh, I just got this little guide that tells me everything I need to know. You know, go to Amazon, get them to add a new credit card, get access to the last four digits of the last credit card, use that as authentication for Apple, and you're in. You know, so it's like whole documentation on how this all works, which is very interesting. Some of the fallout from the article were changes in the way Amazon and Apple do their authentication. And in fact, Apple doesn't do password resets over the air anymore. And Amazon has changed what they do in practice too. So, but that's just two companies. And have changed practices. The question that I would have is, how many other organizations out there have some similar issues where their level of authentication for determining, you know, legitimate customers, you know, how robust are those processes? And we may have to see a few more of these types of articles before we'll see a big change. He did mention the Google two-step verification system. I've actually been using that since it was first available and found it to be very helpful in many situations. And I'm a big believer in using that, but that's just for Google accounts. Certainly, Facebook is another way of doing verification of who you are using mobile devices by sending your codes to registered cell phones, that sort of thing. And I think we're going to see that more in the future, where our mobile devices are not only our ways of accessing information, but also a way of authenticating who we are. And of course, there'll be attacks against that mechanism as well. We'll need to look into that. But I think those are ways that help with the two-factor authentication, at least currently. So I think the fallout of this is going to be some changes. Hopefully, we'll see some companies say, you know what, maybe we should strengthen our practices a little better. And it might be a wake-up call to some people who have not been diligent in making sure they have the right, you know, different passwords for each account, mismanaging their passwords correctly, but also making sure they have a recovery process. That seemed to be part of the problem, not only from a backup point of view. He didn't have the backups of his files, but also his recovery process were tied to a couple key accounts which were compromised. And so, personally, I've got to go back and revisit how I do that as well. I do have good backups, but in terms of recovery for losing access to accounts, I need to rethink that, I think. But and probably most people do as well.
Yes, and I did. I hope I didn't give the impression that two-factor authentication is a bad thing. What I was thinking was, in this case, it really did seem to be more on the social engineering end. I do recommend people to use two-factor authentication, and I use it myself. What was interesting was, and I saw an unrelated article that was kind of an extension of this article, was someone almost hypothesized that, you know, using two-factor authentication in some cases with the social engineering aspect makes it, you know, since it's really difficult to get into an account when it's locked out with two-factor authentication, may in some cases make you more susceptible to the social engineering, because the weak link in all of this was the human beings. I think most human beings have a tendency to want to help. When you get a distressed user, what you believe to be a distressed user on the other end of the line, I can't get into my account. You know, I've got these pictures I really need to get to. I just don't know what happened. I don't have the phone that the two-factor authentication used. And, you know, I can't remember my password because it was in the safe on that phone. Can you please help me out? Can you just give me an account reset? You know, a lot of times people just want to help. Now, one thing I saw in that article was the idea of kind of a delayed reset, where maybe it takes place over the course of a couple hours or even a couple of days. And I thought that might be a pretty good intermediate step, maybe, is, you know, instead of this instantaneous reset access, you know, every account associated with that account would basically receive an email or something saying, within the next 3 hours, you know, a general password reset's going to occur. And maybe that sounds off a little more alarm bells. And if someone happens to be online during that time, or if it's over the course of a couple of days, they can say, well, I didn't issue that. Now, we all like the instantaneous response. We want to get into our account. We want to get into it now. But the trade-off I see coming down the road is we may have to allow for some of those built-in delays, because really, I think the way this whole attack occurred, I think it was what, like less than half an hour before he, you know, everything was pretty much owned. Yeah, I'm kind of looking at the rough timeline, and you know, 4:33 is kind of when it all started on their end, and by 5:02, they had reset the Twitter password, and Matt's first phone call in was like 5:10, and at that point, it was game over. It was already way too late. So, you know, how much, if there had been built an hour or two in each of those steps, maybe he could have become aware before things went as far as they did.
Well, I don't know if social engineering had a whole lot to do with this particular attack. Amazon and Apple both followed their policies. It was bad policies, I think, that was really the what caused this. I mean, Amazon had a policy in place, and the hackers used their policy against them, and Apple also had a policy in place. They have security questions. The hackers failed to answer all the security questions, but Apple has a backup in case you forget all your security questions, where you can give them your billing address and the last four digits of your credit card number, and they will still reset your account. So I think it was a little less social engineering. No one was helpful enough to violate Amazon or Apple's policies. It was the policies that were used against them in order to gain access to those accounts.
Yeah, in the tax code, we call those loopholes. And I think in this case, it's a way of exploiting two organizations, each with partial information, in a way that gets you what you need in the end. So it's kind of a loophole. That's how I'd call it. Well, now we're going to turn to one of our favorite subjects. We seem to have, much like the U.S. government, a fascination with malware associated with Middle Eastern countries. And in this particular case, another piece of malware was discovered recently known as Gauss, and it had very similar characteristics to another malware that we talked about previously known as Flame, which is also in the category of malware such as DuQ and Stuxnet, in that they like to attack Middle Eastern nations. They seem to have a lot of infections in that region. We have speculated, and after that speculation was generally reported in the New York Times as being true, that the United States government does in fact have a fascination with attacking Middle Eastern nations, particularly their nuclear programs. So Gauss is another one that was discovered, was basically noticed roughly about the same time as Flame, but not known as it didn't have as high of infection rate, I believe. And some analysis was done in June, and the command and control servers that were associated with that shut down soon after that in July, I believe it was. So Kaspersky Labs has done some extensive analysis of this particular malware and found that it had some very similar characteristics to Flame, and not only in the way it was designed, the way it infected the system using similar vulnerabilities, but this one had a slightly different purpose in that it seems to want to steal financial information from users. In addition to capturing a lot of information on the system and cookies and sites visited and all that sorts of information, it specifically targeted financial information from some specific banks in Lebanon. The systems infected also happen to be in Israel, the United States, and some other Middle Eastern nations. And they seem to be targeting specific financial institutions, which was very interesting. The other interesting aspect to this particular one at least I found it interesting, and yet the purpose of which is unknown. It actually installed a font on the system. The purpose of that, it was noted as not being fully understood in the report. I found that to be very interesting. Why would malware install a font? But anyways, again, another interesting piece of malware targeting very specific people. The question again is this another system developed or perhaps borrowed, if you will, from the United States government with some particular sense of purpose in mind, or is this more sophisticated malware that seems to be floating around from non-governmental agencies? So I thought I would bring this article and we could talk a little bit about it.
So do you think based on the signature of the malware that this really is kind of being done by a larger organization? For example, this is probably not just a couple programmers kind of messing around. It appears that, you know, it has very specific intent, also in a very specific geographic location. What's interesting is with the bank activity, it makes me wonder what the intent would be. Is it just to know how money's trading hands, or, you know, what would be the incentive for a government to be pursuing this type of data versus a group of organized criminals seeking to obtain financial data? Because I could see, I guess, either scenario being plausible, You know, if you're after financial information, you know, this just could be a rogue group, you know, very big organized group wanting to obtain financial records with the maybe the intent of exploiting it and being able to, you know, skim those accounts. Or it could be a government wanting to just kind of follow the money and see how it's trading hands and to understand what's taking place. You know, it seems like we are starting to see more and more of these things. And I wonder if it's an indication of the fact that the numbers are going up or whether it's an indication of our ability to, you know, because the technology's evolved, it favors the hackers, but it also favors the white hats. You know, are we just becoming better at being able to assess that these things are taking place now?
Well, based on the article, they said that the reason they were able to detect it was because of its similarity between Flame, its design and code base. So, I mean, it seems to indicate that the authors of this malware were probably involved with the Flame malware in some way or another. And I think this is, it's interesting. It claims to basically want to get look at everything on the computer from your browser history to your system config to your cookies. It tries to get passwords and financial information and all that. And it's isolated to a specific region. You'd think an organized crime organization would not care, you know, where they steal their financial information from or their usernames and passwords or whatever. You'd think they just want as many as they possibly could and wouldn't care about what region they got them from.
Yeah, I think the it's not a – it doesn't seem to be a small group of guys in a basement now. It seems to be more larger organizations with sophisticated software design and development techniques involved. There's code reuse, apparently, from Flame. And there is a reason to want to capture financial information from particular regions, and that could be because there are government sanctions in place that prevent certain banking transactions from occurring with certain countries. Well, while we can enforce those in sanctions from our own country, other nations we may not have as much information on. In fact, some countries that have a lot of banking secrecy laws on the books are a little more private in what information they share with government agencies. And so this might be another way for them to track those financial transactions in some way. I'm sure that the real targets of this sort of transactions are probably a little more protected from malware like this, but hey, you never know. You might catch some interesting information out there, and so this might be one way of doing it.
Okay, well, we'll move on to our final article of the day, and this one's on We Know Your House. This article concerns location data that's posted via Twitter. A website's been put up, weknowyourhouse.com, that is meant to be, it calls itself, you know, an educational site in that it takes that location data and says, we believe this user lives at this residence. The folks running the site claim that they only keep the information up there for the past hour, you know, for 1 hour, and then they remove it. So, you know, what they're telling folks is, you know, this is just an easy way to educate the users who may not know any better that, hey, this information is publicly available. And a lot of this came right at this article was posted right about the same time that Michael Dell's daughter was posting stuff on Twitter and had her account suspended for that activity. And of course, Michael Dell is a billionaire, spends over $2 million a year on security. And yet, you know, his daughter was posting information to Twitter about his whereabouts, his location, which could be, you know, very, very dangerous situation for him and his family. So I don't think there was any malicious intent on his children. I think it was more of an education issue. And I'm sure they're probably receiving some educational lessons about this point, about how to be careful about the type of data you share. But this is really the culture that children are growing up in today. This is what their friends do. It's just a common practice to kind of share that information. In his case, it really illustrates, you know, how sharing too much information can be a dangerous thing. So, you know, the folks that run WeKnowYourHouse.com are just basically saying, here, you know, here's how much public information is available. Here's, you know, where these people live. And they're doing it on the premise of, you know, thank you very much. We're helping the world out by providing this service. So I thought this would be an interesting one to discuss today, because I'm kind of torn on these social experiments when they use people's real data. While their intent may be just to educate folks on the dangers of having these location services turned on when you're posting messages to Twitter, there's definitely some danger in what they're doing as well. Just because the data is only on there for an hour doesn't mean that someone can't go to that site and easily find the information on someone and maybe use it against them in the future. So, you know, I kind of get the intent that they're going with. I've seen this kind of happening in our field, and I was curious what everyone else thought about that. You know, is it okay to pull this kind of information together, you know, if you're doing it, you know, what they're claiming kind of is for white hat purposes, just to educate people. You know, there's obviously with everything with white hat and black hat, there's a line. You know, does a site like WeKnowYourHouse.com cross that line? You know, it's definitely, I think, at least get into the gray area. But is it the black hat side now? You know, I mean, are these the types of things that security professionals should be engaging in? Is this the best way to reach folks and educate them?
One of the things is that I seem to recall that 3 or 4 years ago there was a similar service, if you will, and I think it was more like a stealmystuff.com sort of name, and the idea was that it would post information about people that checked in at their own homes using not location services, but the fact that they literally went to Foursquare and said, oh, I'm home now at this address. The problem was that once you were home, these people often tended to check into other places like, oh, I'm now at Starbucks and no one is home. And that would be a way for them, if you were interested, to have an address and to know the time that the person at that house was no longer there, so you could actually break in and steal stuff. So we've seen these things before. But I think it's a bigger issue. I'll go to your point about asking, is this a line that shouldn't be crossed? That's a good question, and I don't know that I have an answer for that. We have another thing that we deal with a lot when we find vulnerabilities in software, and that's the concept of responsible disclosure. The question of whether you go out and you shout to everybody that will hear you, hey, I found this massive hole in this particularly popular piece of software, and oh no, I haven't told the vendor about it yet. Versus the, I'm going to talk to the vendor, I'm going to give them some time to get patches out, and then I'll talk about it. So we have this responsible disclosure idea when it comes with two vulnerabilities, but then there's a social change that needs to occur, if you will, when talking about some of these location services. And sometimes shock and awe is a way of education, sometimes works. I don't know that it's going to this time. But there are some people who believe that the only way to get change in the way things are done is to do these sorts of big splash, newsworthy types of sites. I don't think they work, personally, but we'll see what happens. The question is it a service that people are going to go in and say, you know what, I really don't want to post my location when I send out my tweets and turn it off? Or people are going to accept the risk of doing that. But in the end, the question is, are they going to have an awareness that it's there and be able to manage their risks appropriately by making the right choice for when they post their location? Now, keep in mind, not only does Foursquare and Facebook and all these other services that provide this kind of check-in concept, including Google Latitude and all the others. But anytime you take a picture with your camera phone, your GPS location is embedded in the image. And if you go then and upload that image to a site like Flickr, Flickr, I believe, also has embedded maps to show you where the picture was taken. So if you're taking pictures of your kids in the backyard and putting them on Flickr, well, hello, we now know where you live. So these are, and I don't know if that's still the case, but at one time it was. So these are issues that people have not fully thought about yet, and that's the idea is location-based security. You know, how much information do I want to share about where I'm currently located? So we'll see how that plays out.
Well, and these services are useful also. I mean, if you're on vacation taking pictures, you know, tagging your photos with where you took them, that can be useful. I mean, that's kind of nice. You can see on a map where you were when you took the picture and all that, and that's a nice service. But I think it's not sometimes the easiest to turn this thing on and off. So once it's on, you know, it's on, and you have to remember to turn it off and all that stuff. And also, we talk about these sites on these security podcasts and stuff, but, you know, I don't think the standard user is aware of these sites, nor do I think a lot of them really care that much in a sense, especially some people are, you know, they just don't care about the danger. They don't think, you know, bad things will happen or whatever, and that happens. Now, on the issue of is this a good thing to do, does it work, I have no idea. I'm guessing it probably doesn't. I'm guessing most people don't even know about these sites. I mean, the authors attempted to kind of, if you go to the site, you can see that they start out the names of the Twitter, you know, names of people, and they start out the actual what they think is the home address and all that, and they put these in on here for an hour. I mean, they tried to kind of go on the good side of the line, but it's kind of one of those difficult topics, really.
Yeah, well, these guys went out and put up a site that anonymized a lot of the data. There's a lot of people who have similar access to the Twitter stream who may not be so caring of the information there. So, yeah, they're trying to get some change. Now, the question is, do they want Twitter to change? Do they want Foursquare to change? Do they want any of these location-based check-in services to change? Or do they want user behavior to change? And that's the big question.
Yes, and just looking at the article posted by Sophos, they asked the question. They did a little poll. Now, I have no idea how many people responded, but I know the percentages. They asked, you know, is the site educating us or is it invading our privacy? And based on those who responded, about 43% believed it was educating us versus 57% that felt it was an invasion of privacy. And that was kind of why I thought this would be an interesting one to bring up. I know we've talked about location services before. And I think good general advice is, you know, keep it off unless you explicitly need it on. One of the things I think maybe we'll see in the future, I'm not positive about this, but, you know, I notice, like, on my iPhone, if I go to turn it on or off, it's really just an option of turn it on or off, and I can configure it per app, but there's really no additional information as far as, are you really sure you want to do this? You know, maybe some possible ramifications. Maybe that's where the education starts to get built in. Maybe it gets built in by the app. Folks that put these sites up, maybe they did want to bring it up for the best of reasons. I can think of different ways. Maybe what they should be doing instead is contacting these people via Twitter and saying, hey, you know, this information could disclose your home's location. Maybe you should consider changing it, you know. And, you know, leave it up to the end user to decide. But this, I don't know, this shock value of throwing everything up there. Yes, a lot of people probably are guilty of doing some of these things. But I think in most cases, you know, as Preston already pointed out, they're doing it for good reasons. You know, they do want to take advantages of these features. You know, geotagging a photo while you're on vacation is not necessarily an evil thing, but what's happened is technology's evolved so quickly and so rapidly that, you know, I can be on 3G, 4G when I take that picture, I can post it immediately. And then, as Keith pointed out, you know, my followers can say, well, hey, you know, Mike's on vacation in this location, so we know he's not home at this point. So if there's bad people following, they know there's this window of opportunity, you know. Whereas, you know, maybe if I take the picture, but I wait till I'm home and I'm on my home network, and then I say, here's pictures from my vacation, at that point in time, you know, that the risk goes down a little bit. So, you know, maybe that's just something, you know, I do think it comes down to an education issue. I'm always torn when I see these kinds of things because I see the good, but I also see the evil. I don't want to give the bad guys any additional tools. You know, as you mentioned earlier, Keith, you know, in the Matt Honan hack, you know, some guy was just following a script, you know. So when a site like this gets put up, you know, a lot of people that are not into good things go, well, hey, here's a site where I can find this information very easily. Let's at least make the bad guys work a little bit for the information.
Okay, well, with that, we'll wrap it up. I wanted to thank Keith Watson and Mike Hill as well as Sirius and Secure Purdue. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.